From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk Thanksgiving as we take an etymological trip around the dinner plate. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. I know this doesn't, I guess, apply to either of you anymore, but happy Thanksgiving pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we do. We sometimes do American Thanksgiving here.
Do you? You should, because it's so good.
Yeah, turkey.
We used to, but at this point, it's been so many years, we only do Canadian Thanksgiving, to the extent where I really realized I had changed, because a couple days ago, I saw these ads for Thanksgiving, and I was like, what are they talking about? It's been a month and a half ago. You know, that's what it is. And it was instinctive at this point, which was really interesting, because I thought that I would never get rid of that, you know, traditional. Although in defense of the U.S., I think it's better to have Thanksgiving when they have it. Because you start the season. It's sort of like the opening, you know, I don't know, the opening pitch of the season or something.
It
I like
seems
it.
Weird to have Thanksgiving before Halloween to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. It's like it's so in my head that it's like Halloween, Thanksgiving, and that prepares you for Christmas.
Right.
And also Thanksgiving is sort of, I mean, I'm not sure we're going to go into it this time, but it's sort of a harvest feeling to me, or like post-harvest. Mm-hmm. And early October, things are still warm a lot of times.
Yeah.
You're wearing T-shirts sometimes. Even in Toronto, it was so warm in those days. So you don't get that kind of crisp fall feeling,
Yeah, like stuffing and cranberry sauce.
Yeah.
I just want to say, in Spanish, Thanksgiving Day just doesn't work for me. El Día de Acción de Gracias.
Wow.
It just doesn't.
You guys want to talk about Thanksgiving a little more today?
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about it, but we're going to also do a little bit of grammar, Fletcher, because you're not going to escape grammar. Ooh. But anyway.
First, an email from Bart in Arlington, Virginia.
Hi, Bart.
An idle question that occurred to me. I love these idle questions.
I know.
As I saw an ad for Thanksgiving turkeys. We say that turkeys gobble, and we say that we all gobble down our turkey on Thanksgiving. Are they related? Is gobbling food something that came from Thanksgiving turkeys and spread more widely?
That is an interesting question.
Before
you go into it, I'm going to say no, but what I do wonder is if both of them are sort of like onomatopoeias separately.
Interesting. Not really.
Ah, okay. Can you see why I would
ask? I don't know, Kathy. I'm not sure about that. I think Fletcher may have had a point. Yeah, but your the gobble of eating fast, it's partly, they say, partly echoic, they say.
Oh, they do?
Yes. Look at the OED. Partly echoic, partly frequentative of gob. So it does have, the echoic part gives me.
I saw the gobbin from drinking greedily.
It is, but the gobble part possibly has a slight, you know, gobbing your food. It does probably have a slight echo, or it could be echoic.
See?
I think it does possibly.
See? I watch Cookie Monster go om nom nom a lot, and so I'm very conscious of these eating sounds and words that come out of them.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, because I just saw gobble as a noun. We have it as a noun meaning mouth, and gobbling was gorging and gobbling from gobbin. I'm looking at the OED now. To swallow hastily.
This could be from an etymology thing, but I do see probably partly echoic from the
1600s. Ah, okay, I'm sorry. And the OED, perhaps also partly imitative of the noise of swallowing. Okay,
yes.
I concede.
Wow.
And then the other gobble, I think we can all agree, is probably imitative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is sort of interesting. Do other animals gobble?
Oh. Are there any other animals that I can think of that might gobble? No, not like that. No.
The sound?
No. I don't think it's ever used for anything except for turkeys. I mean, in a general sense, I'm sure someone's going to now write in and like, you know, we have wombats that make a gobble sound, but in terms of general, you know, general usage, I don't think I've ever heard anything. Have you got, I don't,
oh, like we don't, no. Like we don't talk about any other animals gobbling.
No.
Right. I can't think of one.
I can't think of one either. Kathy, you want to do a quick check? I can't find
it. I'm looking right now. I'm not. I'm just seeing that the gobble sounds most commonly made by male turkeys, but there's also a hen-only sound. This is like, I can learn more than I ever wanted to know about vocalization in turkeys.
Yeah.
It's usually, yeah, no, I'm not seeing anything else that sounds like a turkey.
Yeah, we have like turkeys, emus make grunts and booms. Alligators bellow. Dogs growl. Bees
buzz.
Well, the
Wildlife Federation says that turkeys also make purrs, yelps, and kikis.
Well,
ooh, that's interesting.
I think turkeys are probably a lot more interesting and nuanced than we give them credit for, and I'm sure they have all sorts of different sounds.
Well, that's why Ben Franklin, as we recall, wanted them to be our national bird.
That's right.
Yeah. But this is
getting
really
off topic.
Let's
talk about linguistic tricks instead, Frost.
Yeah, I don't think we should go in here. Let's go, yeah, linguistic tricks, pleonasms. Now, Fletcher, Kathy, you want to read your little...
Okay, I said, dazzle your friends, impress your enemies, drop these little words and let people marvel at your linguistic know-how. And the best thing, you didn't know that you're as fancy as you already are. These are hotsy-totsy grammatical and rhetorical devices that you're already using. So we're going to give you one today. This is going to be recurring. Today, can you find the linguistic trick?
But first of all, what do you think a pleonasm is, Fletcher?
Some kind of linguistic trick. No, I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea what a pleonasm is. It sounds mucusy.
It does, actually. I never thought of that, but think of, okay, then let's use the mucus thing. You have a cold. Now, let's use the mucus metaphor to get the definition.
Okay.
You have a cold and you have mucus.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you have a cold, do you have more or less mucus?
I have fewer mucus. I have more. I definitely have more.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And it comes from the Greek word pleon, which is more. And then nasm is sort of tacked on to make it a noun. So it's more. So pleonasm is more words than we need to describe something.
Okay.
Let's see if we can give us some pleonasms right now.
Let me ask you before we do anything. Are these annoying or are they done as rhetorical to be rhetorically attractive?
They can be both. Why don't we read them, Kathy? Let's find the pleonasms
I'm
here.
I'm thinking about, it seems like this is the sort of thing that sports announcers do all the time. Where they use way more words than, like, when they talk about something happening in the month of October. Like, you don't need to tell me in the month.
Okay, well put. Okay, yes, that's a pleonasm. But you can also use them effectively. I mean, like, mm-hmm. they're also used as an effective literary device. Mm-hmm. So it can be, as you said, annoying, or it can be good.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a wide range of what your reaction to this could be.
Yeah. Let's read these first three, Kath. Do you want to do those? And just see if we like them or not.
Okay. I saw it with my own eyes.
Oh, right. I mean, you could just say I saw it.
Right. Okay, next. Buy now and get a free gift.
Oh. Yeah, free gift. That one, I guess, annoys me a little bit if I notice it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's silly.
It annoys you, doesn't it?
Yes, that free gift really bothers me for some reason.
Doesn't bother me at all for some reason.
And going back, though, I saw it with my own eyes. I don't think really is a bad pleonasm at all.
No.
It really
has. That's an emphasizer.
Exactly. It's an emphasizer, yeah. Which is what pleonasm can do, and it can do it legitimately. I saw it has, it's sort of like vague. Okay, great, you saw it. I saw it with my own eyes gives you a wow, you know, and I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm. No, it's an immediacy. Yeah.
What about the last one?
What a lovely, unexpected surprise.
Yeah, I mean, a surprise is going to be unexpected, right? I don't have a problem with that one, though. It kind of.
I don't either.
It kind of emphasizes it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one that annoys some people, it doesn't really annoy me, although I notice it just because I learned it a long time ago, and I learned that it annoyed other people, and I'm sure I do it. And we even got nailed by a listener relatively recently who was going back through our back catalog, because one of us probably said it. Reason why you say,
oh, yes.
The reason why,
yes.
You do something.
Jim because, mentioned it.
Yeah, because you don't need to say why. You just say the reason I did that is. The reason is, right?
Yeah, that's a pleonasm. But I don't, for some reason, I think I'm probably the guilty party on that one. I like the reason why. I think it does, there's a slight pause with the why. It's a slight like filler word in a way. Mm-hmm. And it gives you the reason why I did this. It gives you a feeling of like, there's going to be something said that I wish to emphasize, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a defense of a pleonasm that you two don't like.
Oh, I don't. Like I said, I notice it, which I hate, because it seems like something I shouldn't even bother to notice. But also, mm-hmm. I am absolutely not editing my own speech that rigorously. You know, sometimes Mm-mm. sometimes I might say it, sometimes I might not. I'm definitely mm-hmm. not going to think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
But it does bother some people. Like it absolutely bothers the heck out of some people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we're going to move on to why don't we go through these literary? Because in many cases they're okay. Kathy had a problem with one of these literary devices.
I did. Well, I did because I didn't think it was really a pleonasm. Mm.
Okay.
Okay, the first is Shakespeare, of course. This was the most unkindest cut of all. It's from Julius Caesar.
Is it the most and the est? The most unkindest?
Yes,
correct.
Yeah. Got it.
Now, this one, Ross and I debated. This is Raymond Chandler, The Big Sleep, but I'm a huge Chandler fan. He wrote, "Beyond the garage were some decorative trees trimmed as carefully as poodle dogs."
I don't know whether people used to call them poodle dogs.
That's my argument. Thank you, Fletcher. That was what I said to Ross.
Yeah, I think he was being sort of funny. I mean, I think he was sort of playing with it a little bit, is my feeling. Like, aren't these people precious? Uh-huh. So I think poodle dogs, as carefully as poodles, doesn't have that same zip. So
absolutely.
I think I have no problem with it. I think that's fine.
But I also think that they probably called them poodle dogs back in
the... I'm looking it up right now. That's a good question.
I was wondering, was it just how you just said it? You just said, like, oh, yeah, they have a poodle dog. Like, it wasn't as a widely, you know, the breed wasn't as... I don't know. That's what I thought.
But if they do say it, it's still... There's no such thing as a non-dog poodle, probably, or not that much.
A non-poodle? A poodle
non-poodle
dog?
Non-poodle dog. That's a weird word, actually, poodle. I never really thought too much about it. No, a lot of people have poodle dog now. They called them poodle dog. But if they did call it poodle dog, it's still a pleonasm.
It is. And I no one can say anything bad about Raymond Chandler. So that's that.
But actually, though, a hound dog would be also a pleonasm.
True.
You know, the more you're saying poodle dog, the cuter it's getting.
Oh, was it?
Okay, the final pleonasm. Ross, you want to do Beckett?
Okay. Let me tell you this. When the social workers offer you free, gratis, and for nothing, something to hinder you from swooning, which with them is an obsession, it is useless to recoil. Samuel Beckett was very prolix.
I like it. I like it. Free, gratis, and for nothing. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a clear, I think that's clearly a good usage of a pleonasm right there.
Yeah.
Well, this next one bothers me a little bit. I have relatively little money. And someone said here, relatively little is a pleonasm because words like little, big, fun, or subjective, that's always relative. I think relatively little works for me.
Yeah.
Does it work for you all?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think whoever wrote that, that's just silly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's just so picky.
It's also, I think it's incorrect.
I agree. I mean, we can go into, we don't need to go into the different types of pleonasms, do we, Ross? I don't think so. Semantic and syntactic.
Well, we can just quickly say it's a syntactic pleonasm is a redundancy that is grammatical in nature. Double negatives, for example, would be syntactic pleonasm, syntax, how you put words in a sentence. And then semantic pleonasms are when you're like things like extra words, free gift, etc.
Mm-hmm. Up north, tuna fish.
Beefsteak.
Do people say beefsteak anymore?
No. We have it written here, but I don't think anyone, I don't know, it's occasionally.
Isn't that a kind of tomato?
Beefsteak
tomato.
Yes, it is.
You're right. You're right. I think nowadays the pleonasm true fact has a certain meaning there that I don't think it did for a while back. You know what I mean?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
I was just going to say, but it's fascinating when you look at the list, how many pleonasms we use just every day.
Yeah, let's just read them off. Yeah.
I mean, seriously, it's that's why I really like this as a topic, because we don't think of them as pleonasms. To fall down is a pleonasm. Mm-hmm. To rise up is a pleonasm. Added bonus.
Safe haven.
Oh, pleonasm.
Wow. Tuna fish.
Pin number.
Yeah.
It's true, because people are hear this.
Definitely.
You know, we've mentioned this before. Let's go back to tuna fish, because if I'm eating tuna fish and you're eating tuna, then I think of two different things.
As do I.
Tuna fish is the stuff that comes out of the can that's all chopped up.
And they put mayonnaise and celery and stuff in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And tuna might be like a tuna steak or something.
Yeah.
Sliced, right? Not chopped up.
Yep, I think you're right. I mean, that's, again, we go back to the interesting thing about pleonasms. They do have value in many cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, a PIN number, I think I would never say what's your, well, I could say what's your PIN, but PIN number basically specifies it too. So I don't think it's particularly bad.
Mm-mm.
Down south, I think, is pretty useful too.
Mm-hmm.
Up north.
Mm-hmm. Back east.
Yeah. Past history.
Well, past history, that sounds... I don't know. That one I don't like.
I don't
like.
Know. Past history? I don't know. I don't. Just saying history doesn't seem to work to me. It's like, you know that's all past history. That's like, you know, that to me sounds better than going, that's all history. That's all past history.
Yeah, it emphasizes it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you repeat that again, Kathy?
Okay, that's not good. Although, if I had already repeated it.
Yeah, then you would be repeating it again, but you could still just say repeat it.
Yeah, you could still.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on to Thanksgiving.
Mm.
So we're going to go into a little segment quiz on Let's Talk Food.
Yes.
Thanksgiving words that we're talking about with the coming up wonderful holiday.
Yes.
And the first one is true or false. Turkey is named after the country.
Oh, no, I've read this. Oh, I don't know if we've talked about this. Ah, heck, I don't remember the answer. Okay, let me think. I want to say no. I'm going to say no. I feel like I might be wrong.
Do you really want to say no, Fletcher?
Do I really want to? That's really questionable right now, but I'm going to say no. What I mean is yes. Yes, yes, it is. Is it?
Yes.
It really is.
The bird... is named after the country. It's a very roundabout thing, though.
Yeah. Tell me how we get there.
Ross, you want to explain?
No, you go ahead, Kath. This is your...
Okay, this was mine, because it's like really kind of like...
You really got into this. Yeah.
What? I did. I don't know why.
Kathy kept going on and on. I got all confused because there's so many little eddies and backwaters with turkey.
I was fascinated. Well, I know. Love turkey, too. So the bird and the country. They think that what it was the bird was domesticated, what we call a turkey now, by the Aztecs, and the conquistadors found it, and they applied the word turkey to it because it was imported to the rest of Europe from Spain by way of North Africa, which was under Ottoman rule.
Wow.
So it was... considered like a it was also very exotic that way. So it was like a turkey bird. It was like via Turkey that everybody in Europe got the bird.
Wow.
Kevin, I got a little bit confused here because in one of your notes, you said in English, they did it in reference to the guinea fowl, which you went at length on Friday telling me about, a bird imported from Madagascar via Turkey. And it was called the guinea fowl when brought by the Portuguese from West Africa. And you explained it with eloquence the other day. But
I'm very tired, Ross.
But is that an alternate route that it went from Africa, Madagascar? That's just weird to me.
I don't know, because I have here, it got to Europe by Spain by way of North Africa.
Yeah, and then up here you have here, I'm looking at what you had written
I
here.
I see that. That let's ignore that note, Ross.
Okay.
That is an errant note.
Okay, but it's a possibility.
It is a possibility. The bottom line is the turkey was named after Turkey by way of different possibilities. But the key is that the bird was imported by way of Turkey somehow, whether it was the Ottoman rule in North Africa or from Madagascar via Turkey.
Okay, I'm going to now throw in an interesting little factoid here. The Turkish name in Turkey, the name for the animal turkey is Hindi, literally Indian, probably influenced by the French dinde, which is poulet d'Inde, which is chicken from India. So, and then didon would be the modern term. And then I got curious. I looked up Arabic word for turkey, and it's dikrumi, which is Roman rooster.
Oh, my God.
Which is really weird. So we have everyone not giving the Aztecs any credit for having
for the turkey.
It. Yeah. But, Kath, why don't you go on with the other one with turkey game? That was sort of interesting, too, that you went through.
Oh, I got curious that after turkey, about Turkey Day, like people calling it Turkey Day.
Oh, sure.
I got curious. Okay, Fletcher, quick question. When do you think it started being used to refer to Thanksgiving? The 1910s, the 1860s, or the 1790s?
Oh, boy. 1860s.
You got it.
Nice.
Kathy found this really cool ad, too. I mean, I never would have thought this. Propelling for Turkey Day, all aboard that's going. How came you so? And it's from an ad of the Boston Herald, 1863, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
They say that it became like big the year that Lincoln made the holiday official, which was 1863. So I would just have thought Turkey Day was more like the 30s or the something.
I completely agree with you, Kathy. It sounds to me like a 30s sort of thing.
Yeah, even though I didn't
put
30s in there. Yeah,
no.
I wouldn't have thought 1860s. But they said it was huge back then in 1860s.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I didn't know.
No, it was huge. And it became like a big thing. Like it became like Black Friday. It's like Turkey Day.
Turkey
was
Day.
In ads and stuff.
Yeah.
That's weird. Okay, let's move on now. This is a fun one. When we toast someone, does it have to do with, one, literal toasted bread, two, a contraction from the phrase twix roste and suete, as the toast thanked the host for the roast and proceeded dessert. And Kathy, tell our wonderful little sign that we had at our grandparents' house.
When we were kids at our grandparents' house, who were very Greek, Yampapoos,
they're
had
Greek.
This little... cross-stitch thing, and it said, first the toast, then the roast. Happy hostess, happy host.
And for some reason, we were both like utterly fascinated by that little thing. We kept staring at it. I don't know why. And it's funny because independently we did. I found out years later that Kathy was as fascinated by that as I. Okay, but let's go back to why toast someone. Does it have to do with literal toasted bread, a contraction from the phrase twix roste e suete, as a toaster thanked the host for the roast and proceeded dessert, from the Latin potio, potion, from the Greek teraste, to become dry, i.e. when you're toasting someone, you're replacing or replacing the dryness.
I feel like I should have heard this somewhere, and so I should have an inkling of what it is, and I'm surprised that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be Latin, but I really like that Greek one you said. So let's go with the Greek one.
Okay. Close, but no cigar.
Was it Latin?
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
Not close. Okay. No cigar.
It was
I should have said close. It's toast. Literal toasted bread.
Oh, wow. Why?
There's some thought that it might be from the use of spiced toast to flavor drink. It adds piquancy to the wine when it's drunk to a person's health. Or it could be that they put a little bit of toast in a mug of ale. It's apparently well attested in many 17th century drinking songs.
Hmm.
I would never have guessed that.
Mm-mm.
No.
Toasted bread sounds like ridiculous. It sounds like, yeah, right.
No, it sounds very stupid. No offense. I mean, I know it's true, but it does. I would never have thought toast. Also, spiced toast in a drink doesn't sound good to me.
No, it's like one of those words. And when we wrote this down, we both got a little bit worried that we're going to get some, you know, like culinary person who's an expert on this or whatever. Because I still, even though this is attested in various etymologies, I don't like it. It just seems really kind of weird.
No, it just
weird.
Seems wrong. I agree. I think it should be the Greek one as well,
Fletcher. Yeah, I know.
We're going to make this really quick. If you, this is just, you probably don't know, but do you know what a wishbone has to do with marriage?
No.
Break the wishbone.
I've never heard anything about this.
The wishbone, they used to say that, first of all, the wishbone was called the Merry Thought, which I personally prefer to wishbone, because it represented the repository of life. I'll be very vague. A woman's nether regions. So if you ended up with the longer piece of the Merry Thought, you would marry first. Get it? Merry Thought, marry first.
Oh, I see.
It's like
I see.
They punned back in the 17th century. I like that. Alternatively, they thought that you got your wish with the longer one, which is what it has become obviously now. Mm-hmm. But that, they think, went back to the Etruscans, where they divined the future with rooster clavicles.
Although, interestingly enough, can I throw a little bit of Latin crap in here or not?
You may.
Well, this is actually not Latin, Etruscan, which is completely unrelated, but that would be electromancy, which they did. And there was also another thing they would do with chickens. And they'd put a circle of like corn around, I guess wheat kernels, we would say then, around a chicken. And whatever the chicken like pecked.
Oh.
They would like take the order and they would have like letters of the
I've
alphabet.
Heard of that.
They'd be placed around it.
Mm-hmm.
So electromancy is a word, Fletcher, that I think we should use frequently.
What is that? Because it sounds to me like electroplated jewelry or something, doesn't it?
I don't know. Actually, that's an interesting question, Kat. I think it comes
I've never heard it.
What, electromancy?
Yeah,
I think it comes from, mancy would be divination. Mm-hmm. And then I think electron is a Greek word for, chicken or rooster. So it's like rooster divination.
Oh, wow.
I guess.
Oh, fascinating.
Hmm.
So Fletcher, at Thanksgiving dinner, you can say, let's all practice a little bit of Etruscan electromancy.
Yeah.
But you have to have a chicken then there, huh?
Oh. Yeah, but we're deriving it. We now have gone on to turn. They didn't have chickens. They didn't have chickens in Greece in the Etruscan day, I mean. They didn't have them in Italy. So let's switch.
Speaking of switching, is it turkey dressing or turkey stuffing?
Oh, man.
What's the difference?
This is another one of yours, Kath. You love this one, too.
I do, too. I do. Well, I love stuffing.
Oh, so do I.
I do.
And dressing.
Mm-hmm.
I love both of them. I would have assumed that this was just like a regional difference and it was the same thing. But you're going to tell me it's not. I don't know. Does it depend on whether you actually stuffed it inside the turkey or not?
It's both. You're right. It's a regionalism. And some say if you stuff it, you stuff the stuffings in the bird, the dressings in the casserole dish in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
But they're usually used interchangeably.
Yeah.
South is more common dressing. Pennsylvania Dutch or Pennsylvania in general, they call it filling.
Filling.
More, which I've never heard. Did you hear filling, Ross? Did
no,
you know
I was
filling?
Just nodding. I just saw what you had written. I just nodded my head. No, I have never
heard. Yeah.
We used to go to Pennsylvania a lot. I never heard filling.
Nor but I.
Our grandmother, one of our grandmothers who did not speak very good English and did not like participles, always referred, do you remember that, Kathy? She always said.
No, she always called stuff.
Yeah, the stuff. You want this stuff now, Spinos? I go, oh, yeah, I'll have some stuff. But she goes, stuff. But she had like a real, like a
punch with it.
I know there was. You want the stuff, so we go. Yeah, we'll have the stuff. So
I use stuffing. Do you? What do you guys use? I say stuffing.
You know what?
Stuffing.
I think I might say both.
Well, dressing is more common in the South, we said. So I'm just wondering if Kansas would have more of a connection to the South.
Kansas
or not.
Is,
I don't know.
No, it's in a weird place where we sort of have an influence from all over.
All areas.
Yeah, and so we end up using a lot of words that are regional to other places.
Mm-hmm. What about Canada, Ross? Did you? Because I'm seeing what I had seen online in a linguistics forum, but I'm curious if you've heard.
Well, I think in Canada it would have been dressing more, actually.
That's what they said in this thing I had seen.
Hmm.
But now I hear stuffing a lot, so I don't really know. Also, we tend to go to our in-laws, and we always have ham usually, so
that complicates things.
Yeah, no. And then I have slide by my wife then buys after we come back, then we buy a frozen turkey, which is really cheap, but we don't stuff it then, so
I was surprised because I would have thought stuffing would have been older than dressing, but the OED In terms of the stuffing, like the stuff that's like we're talking about, the OED has dressing first as stuffing.
I would think dressing would be older because I think, and we, Kathy and I talked about this. I also heard it as dressing, you know, like a deer when you, you know, you catch wild game,
sure,
you dress it. So I'm just thinking like maybe you're basically doing something to it. So then it would evolve into, you know, stuffing it. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's still dressing. Maybe that's what I would have thought.
Oh,
I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't. I mean, they're both in the 1500s. So, I mean, I'm being very, you know, we're
technical.
Talking only. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go into now. We're moving into the potato course, which is another.
I was very hungry. When
I know. And she got me all confused on this one, too, because also my wife kind of chimes in with yams versus sweet potatoes.
Oh,
so
oh yeah. Don't get me.
I don't want to go into this.
I did not put yams in.
I know. But let's talk potatoes versus sweet potatoes. Kathy, go to it.
Why do you call them both potatoes when they're different things? What's with this?
Well, I mean, one of them's sweet, right? I don't know what's the problem here. Don't you pull both of them out of the ground, right? So,
what do you think in terms of Europeans, which came first?
Oh, the sweet potato.
Yes. Go on, Cap. Go to it.
Okay, first it was Christopher Columbus took sweet potatoes back to Spain with the name Patata, which was the Indian name. And then decades later, the Spanish found the regular potato in Peru, which they called papas. So you have, which they're not really called here anymore. So the English got these two foods. So they had the sweet potato, they called potatoes after the patata, and the regular potato, they called Virginia potatoes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought that was really
cool. I think it's really interesting. It really is.
So then Virginia potatoes became more popular than sweet potatoes. So the Virginia went by the wayside, and they both were called potatoes. But then as your basic potato became even more popular, they added, the English added the word sweet to sweet potatoes, so they were differentiated from your basic potato.
Holy moly.
I'm just fascinated with Virginia potato.
I am too. I never would have known that. I never would have. That's really, I think it's really interesting with that. Mm. I like both types of potatoes too, so that I know what they were called. But I think it's time for dessert.
All right.
So let's have a little dessert, okay? We're stuffed on stuffing and sweet potatoes and regular potatoes and everything. So let's have a little bit of a pie. Now, was the word pie initially derived from piebald, referring to a variegated horse flank, by extension to the variegated ingredients in a pie? From the Old English word pie, P-Y-E, or daisy. From the Latin pica, magpie, the bird famous for its variegated elements in its nest. From pasta, Latin dough for pastry cake, pasty, pasty pie with an I-E diminutive, i.e. a little round pastry cake.
Oh, boy.
So we got piebald, daisy, magpie, pasta.
Give me the little daisy, the P-Y-E. It's shaped like a...
Okay, from the Old English word pie, daisy.
Yeah. I want to choose that one.
Well, I think really? You're a little bit wrong. No, it's really interesting. It comes from pica magpie.
Oh.
Possibly in relation to the bird's habit of collecting miscellaneous objects.
So you just... Because you put stuff in there?
Yeah. First baked dish of pastry was filled with a mix of... pies used to have meat in them. A lot of meat pies were more common. Meat, spices, all covered with pastry and baked.
Oh, boy. Wow. Mm,
that sounds good right now. I'm hungry suddenly. Yeah.
Like I want a meat pie and then a fruit
too.
Pie. I want sweet potatoes, too.
Okay. Yeah, I do too, Kathy.
I was fascinated. Pie chart didn't come about until 1922, just like a few years before the Depression. It's like... Okay, now, we're talking about pies. What kind of pie are we going to have? Mm-hmm. We're going to have a pumpkin pie.
Of course.
Now, where did the word pumpkin come from?
Oh, gosh.
Hmm? The ancient Greek pepien?
Pepain.
Pepain, to cook. The Latin pompa, a special procession with many colorful elements. The Middle Dutch pompe, pipe, and later to inflate, referring to the large aspect of the gourd. And finally, the Algonquin word for pumpkin. Oh, gosh. Pumacockingon.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Pumacockingon.
Yes, good, Kat. Good pronunciation.
Thank you. Ancient Greek, Latin, Middle Dutch, Algonquin.
I think it has to be Middle Dutch or Algonquin. But where? You're tempted to say Algonquin, right? I'm going to go with Middle Dutch. Middle Dutch is what it is.
Really?
Wrong. Actually, and I'll add one more thing. When I was congratulating Kathy on her Algonquin word, I made it up. So I could be very, basically be very authoritative on the pronunciation of that word.
Yeah. I was actually wondering how you knew that that's how the Algonquin said it. I didn't realize, though, of course, Paponi. It didn't occur to me.
Yeah, we both grew up.
It's Greek.
In Greek, it's Paponi, and it's from the Greek. Pepain is to cook in ancient Greek in Greek, and it's basically cooked by the sun. And the word for melon in Greek is Pepon or Paponi, which for some reason that word stuck to me, and I still think of melons as Paponi. Don't you?
Paponi, cantaloupe, but not other ones, just cantaloupe. For
Yeah, you're right. Huh. So Fletcher.
Is hungry.
Let's have a little bit. I think we should all get off the show and get ready to have a little pumpkin pie. I'm going to have a meat pie first, though, I think.
You've got to read. Ross found this wonderful American poem.
Oh, good.
Poem, early American poem about pumpkin.
I love this. Okay, I'll read it. America is a dandy place. The people are all brothers. And when one's got a pumpkin pie, he shares it with the others.
That's just cute.
I want that pumpkin pie.
I do too.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org. or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.